Welcome to the Daily French Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Daily French Show. Sorry, I forgot which podcast I'm on. A bad day.
That's fine.
I'm, of course, your host, your forgetful, bumbling host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Miss Saragon. Sarah, how are you?
I tend to be a bit bumbling and forgetful too, so I'm with you, brother.
Very good. Good to know that I'm in good company. And Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I mean, apart from facing existential dread, I'm envious of your forgetfulness. As I was listening to this opening jingle, I just thought, boy, this podcast it begins so hopeful. I mean, really just so cheerful, and your Soweto strings just doing their thing, and then we just arrive on the scene.
Well, look, when people stop messing around with the country and actually everything starts going better, then I think the podcast will be nothing but delight and humor and good times. And then we can probably hang up our hats and retire into obscurity. Perhaps not, but we shall see. So I guess we need to talk about what the title of this episode, you've probably seen, IRR journalist attacked in Mpumalanga. So our colleague, Gabriel Krauser, he of even greater beard than I, has gone off to Mpumalanga to investigate the story about some killings of farm workers in Piet Retief, also known as Mkhondo, in Mpumalanga. There was an alleged race incident there where some white farmers allegedly attacked some black farm workers who were asking for work or raise or something like that. Anyway, we heard that there might be some problems with the police's version of the story, with the official version of the story. So Gabriel was sent off to investigate whether there was any truth to those claims, and he has found that there is another version of the story entirely. But he will talk about that when he's on the show on Thursday. However, he was attending court proceedings related to this to sort of keep investigating what was going on. And while he was there, he tried to get an interview with the police, just to get their comment on a particular aspect of the story. And he was pushed around from pillar to post. The police kept telling him to go this place. And this whole time, there was a very, shall we say, bad-tempered crowd of ANC and EFF supporters who were there, who were chanting all sorts of things. And there's a picture of it on the website. That's where we're getting the story from. If you go to thedailyfriend.co.za, it's called Fear and Loathing in Mkhondo. Man stabbed, four others, including IRR journalists, attacked. Anyway, so Gabriel, in pursuit of this policeman, was sent by the police to a Total garage three blocks down the road. And when he arrived at the garage, he saw no police. Instead, there were protesters, many in ANC and EFF branded attire, one of whom, in a plain green shirt, shouted Mlungu at him while staring him down. He decided to turn the car around because it didn't look like a good situation. The guy kicked his tire of his car and told him, Mlungu, F off. Then another person ran at him in the car and threw a rock at him at the windscreen. And the person shouted, I'm going to give my bad Zulu pronunciation here, but Mlungu Nkizabu Kubula, white person, I will kill you. And then he heard some more rocks hitting against the roof of his car. So he drove away from the garage after having the windscreen smashed. He later found out that there were some other people being attacked by the stone throwers. He goes into detail about who all the victims were, but there at least seems to be a racial element to some of these attacks. And he associates it. He says that it seemed to be coming also from the EFF and the ANC crowd there. So what can we make of this? How can we fit this into the bigger picture? This is, you could put this down to just the lawlessness that pervades rural South Africa. But it does seem to me to be a bit more insidious that the situation of this criminal proceeding has been made much worse by this political interference. Herman, let me start with you. What's your take on this story? I should mention, Gabriel says he's fine. Nothing bad has happened to him, but I'm sure he'll be able to fill us with more details when he's on the show on Thursday. Herman, your thoughts?
Yeah, so I think you're right in flagging the general lawlessness, something that I've been looking into and trying to read some sociological analysis of is why South Africa is such a violent country. I mean, we are a terribly violent country. I mean, by global standards, astonishing.
In the top 10 of the whole world.
Yes.
Possibly around number 9, somewhere around there.
And this sort of petty violence occurs, I mean, in a town with heightened police presence. So you have this element, I think, of lawlessness. I think you have an element of South Africa just being a violent society, of course, made no better by its history, but that being no excuse for not seeking improvement. Then you have the problem of the police being, you know, as what's the moniker or the description that Michael Gove so tellingly used of Jeremy Corbyn, present but not involved. The police present but not involved in maintaining law and order. And then I think you also have the design of this. I echo your sentiment, Nick, that there's something devious going on here. I don't think one can dismiss these things. It's an election year. The ANC is running out of road, and I mean it's very clear that they only have the race card in many instances left to play. But
more than that, if I could just interject here, is that the EFF seems to be unashamedly joining forces with the ANC at this point. The fighting between the two seems to mostly be gone. It's all directed at Cyril now, and the EFF is embarking on a deliberate project to destroy race relations in South Africa.
Yes, and I think that's certainly a part of it. And the one thing that I remember from our visit to Senekal last year, with sort of similar circumstances, I don't think the situation was this heightened, because the deceased in that case was a young white man. So the aggrieved, angry racial grouping was very much not typically ANC EFF affiliated, where in this case it's just this very potent cocktail of alleged white murders, murderers, black victims, and then the narrative of black blackness being under attack, and you know, just the potency of it. And what reminds me specifically about the Senekal incident is I remember speaking to black people on the street there, you know, observing the circus coming into town, that the protesters and the violent, you know, the real instigators of aggression and violence and disorder were bussed in from other communities. The communities themselves, so often in these cases, are, you know, immensely human. Understanding of the fact that a human life had been destroyed, perhaps multiple lives destroyed by this incident, and that much is at stake on a human level. But then you do get the fabricated hatred and anger that is so obviously politically motivated. And in that, there's a blessing and a curse. The curse is that the EFF and the ANC have nowhere else to go, and they will go continuously and increasingly down this route. So that's the curse. It's immensely dangerous. We're on a very, very dangerous trajectory. But the blessing is that that outrage has to be manufactured, that it has to be parachuted in by political forces, which in a weird way is something to be pleased and glad about and hopeful about, that the people actually affected, the communities actually affected by these instances are not the people yelling death threats at a white journalist, really just asking questions. So it's a cocktail of all of these things, and I think it would be irresponsible to try and, you know, pinpoint it's that or that. But it depressed me. So seriously, I joked beforehand that, you know, I woke up this morning with you know, today was going to be a good day. And I read that and it really threw me. And there's this primitive problem that I have that we have data from the Institute, 10 years worth of data showing that there is this moderate middle, but there is something immensely powerful to anecdotal telling of suffering. And I think that's part of why this whole lived experience thing has become so popular, is that the data might say one thing, might say that there is this moderate middle in South Africa, but it's very, very difficult to read of a lived experience and not be moved on a human level, almost against your will, to be despairing of you know, the country.
Right. No, radicals are often are almost always the minority. I mean, that's kind of how their radicalness is defined. And yet, by actions like this, they punch far above their numbers would suggest. I must say, this is not, I've never had such a dramatic encounter as Gabriel's just gone through, having rocks thrown at him and people threatening to kill him. But I have had sort of slightly, shall we say, physical confrontational run-ins with ANC EFF types before. And when from my experience, when the ANC or something tries to cause trouble in a way like this, they'll go and they'll get a bunch of people and they'll give a lot of drinks out to people and they hype them up. And then they basically, without anyone directing it, they just sort of create the conditions of chaos to emerge sort of naturally. So everyone is a bit drunk and a bit angry and looking for a fight. It's like those people who go to a bar looking for a fight. That's kind of the environment they create around this. And predictably, this is what happens. People get attacked. Someone was stabbed. That was actually why Gabriel was sent to that police that total garage, was because he was told that the police were there investigating a man who had apparently just been stabbed. So, Sarah, Nick,
just on that point, this is a pressure cooker, and the pressure is building and building. Each of for every such incident really motivates the extremes on both sides to be angrier, and it's a terrible pseudo prediction to make. But I can really see it happening, serving the ANC in the EFF's narrative, that one day there will just be a farmer that loses it, that has a gun, that has a bucky, and that the potential for a pseudo lone gunman terrorist attack, if these kind of pressures continue to build up, is something I'm genuinely fearful of, right? Because not just the loss of life, but the use then that will be put to.
And there's radicals on both sides, and you see this all the time in online discourse, who are happy and eager for this prospect because they think, yes, my side, whether it's the right or the left or the black or white or whatever, however they can view the conflict, they say it's going to be great because we're going to win. Firstly, I mean, that's definitely behind the EFF's thinking. Firstly, you don't know that. And secondly, I would point anyone who thinks that a civil war can be anything other than a total nightmare to pictures of what Syria currently looks like. And it is not, shall we say, a place worth living. Sarah, we've had you out for a while. Apologies for that.
From an election point of view, is racism, anti-white racism. Obviously, the EFF and the ANC decided to assemble the crowd, wherever the crowd came from, however they came, and to, as you say, let it form a dynamic suitable to violence and collect. I mean, the place, Gabriel points out, the place was full of policemen, but the policemen were kind of doing pretty much nothing. So either they were in cahoots, or they support the ANC, the EFF, or whatever the case may be, it doesn't matter. The police did not do what they should have done. And, of course, there's the other element of surmising that part of the reason for the police inaction, it was actually directing independently four white motorists to an area where they were bound to be assaulted, attacked, or worse, may have something to do with the fact that, you know, that very, very literally, as the crime scene was being investigated, the narrative that the police came out with, the farmers had shot and killed these two brothers, became quite different. And part of the difference came in because the police had failed to manage the crime scene properly. So I think what you have here is because of either incompetence or animus or for a whole lot of reasons that I dare not even think of being on payrolls, perhaps, it's a bit like the Collini affair, which ironically Gabriel is well acquainted with, and that is the fact that very quickly the EFF and the ANC set up a narrative that creates a scene that finding the possibility of not finding those white farmers guilty of murdering the black workers becomes almost untenable. We have an almost George Floyd scenario. And I think this is how grubby and despicable ANC politics has become. EFF we've never expected terribly much from, but I think the ANC has sunk to the point where its ability to do anything helpful to society has pretty much passed.
Well, let me just say that despite some of the problems in the George Floyd trial with, you know, protesters threatening witnesses and test people, that kind of thing, our situation here is much worse. Precisely because I think, firstly, the level of violence being enacted is much greater. And secondly, because at least in the US, the court proceedings are running well and the justice system at its core is still strong and functional. Gabriel and I recently talked about this on a podcast about how the US system is really showing that it can have very thorough, solid court cases in the public eye and still function. Whereas in South Africa, it's just a mess.
Yeah, I think the problem is that South Africa can function like that. You know, the processes and the rule of law are there. The problem is you get magistrates put under pressure, as happened in the Collini case, or whatever the reasons were for the appalling judgment that came out there. But even in the States, you know, I suspect that whatever the correctness of the judgment may be, if it's anything deviating from what the crowd, Antifa and BLM want, and Maxine Waters, the congresswoman, there will be trouble anyway. So there's almost an element of it almost doesn't matter. But if we want to be credible, judicially credible, we have to make sure that the right thing happens here. And it may not be the popular thing.
Right. My point is, though, I think that, you know, at least the police in the US can sort of collect evidence for the trial and that sort of thing. Like, even in our Oscar Pistorius case, which was, of course, one of the biggest stories in South Africa for ages, the police came under heavy criticism for allegedly messing up the crime scene and stuff like that. And that's certainly going to be part of the story. But we will come back to it later in the week. We'll get the first-hand account of what exactly is going on from Gabriel himself, and he'll talk about the situation, what happened to him, and also the case and what he's found out by investigating a bit. Right, so with that on our minds, we shall move over to South Africa's vaccine rollout plan. Now, government, I believe, had originally planned to vaccinate 2/3 of South Africans by the end of the year. This is a plan they set for themselves. You know, Cyril Ramaphosa, beginning of the year, basically promised that COVID would be finally and completely conquered by the end of this year. And it's turned out that South Africa's vaccine rollout program has not been, shall we say, as efficient as people would have hoped. It's so far been almost entirely contained for medical healthcare workers. And some people in the media and in government's orbit and in government itself have blamed what they call vaccine nationalism, which is the supposed hoarding of vaccines by the First World, or vaccine apartheid, as in there's some countries with access to vaccines and others which don't have access to them, and that this is the reason that South Africa is slow. Well, I was annoyed by this line of reasoning because I thought that it was a bit silly, so I just drew up a quick list here of countries and what percentage of their population have had at least one shot of a vaccine, and then compare them to South Africa. So we've got countries like Israel, the United Kingdom, the United States, with, you know, all close to half of their populations vaccinated by this point. You know, you'd expect that. Those are pretty technologically advanced countries, pretty wealthy countries. Most of Europe is around 1/5 of their population vaccinated, a little bit less. Morocco is doing quite well. I think it's ahead of all the countries in Africa. It's got about 12% of its population vaccinated. But then you start to get into countries where you start to think maybe South Africa should be ahead of them. People know that Argentina is a country with a lot of economic problems. They're on about 12%. India, a population which is both very poor and very large, being about 23 times approximately South Africa's size, has had 7% of its population vaccinated. El Salvador, a small Central American country that is both poor and violent, having the highest homicide rate per 100,000 people in the world, has 7% of its population vaccinated. Rwanda, a country with an eighth of the GDP per capita of South Africa, has 3% of its population vaccinated. Ghana is a quarter of the wealth of South Africa, has 2% of its population vaccinated. Zimbabwe, also around 2%. And of course, we all know about Zimbabwe's problems. South Africa is currently sitting on around 0.5% of its population vaccinated. We are currently behind Nigeria, Guinea, Gambia, Lesotho, Angola, Ukraine, which is at war with its neighbor Russia, Kenya, Malawi, a country with 14 times less wealth per person than South Africa. The kind of countries we're ahead of are Mozambique, Uganda, and Ivory Coast. So the question is, perhaps it's not vaccine nationalism. There will probably be an article about this published in the Daily Friend tomorrow, which you can check out. Sarah, if it's not vaccine nationalism, what exactly is the problem here?
Incompetence. I think it's a synonym for incompetence. And I hate it when they start to become whinging from leaders that it's vaccine nationalism. Look, it's not been easy for any countries to get the vaccines. I mean, a whole lot of the first world countries are waiting for vaccines that they haven't yet got. And to say, well, we're poor and ignorant and African, and therefore, you know, we're suffering from vaccine apartheid, is just absolutely pathetic. Part of the problem, I mean, I know that not all the doctors, not all the medical staff in South Africa have been vaccinated yet. I mean, I know they're opening up registration to older people, but I don't know when they're actually going to get to them. The South African SAHPRA, the organization, the governmental organization that approves vaccines, has now approved J&J. But the government has said to the department, the province, you know, Western Cape, don't worry about vaccines, we've got enough for you. Okay, well then, where the hell are they, and why aren't we being allowed to get on with it? So it's a combination of the natural incompetence of the ANC, mixed up with the fact that they are desperately want to be seen to remain in control of this process, and God forbid it should go to the DA-run Western Cape or the private sector. So we would rather end up, I don't know if we maps unrolling the vaccine process, but we are really at the bottom of the list, and more the shame to us.
Right. This is exactly the point. You know, we're not just slow by like compared to the first world. We're slow compared to everyone. Malawi is like one of the poorest countries on earth, and it's ahead of us. It's twice as much of its population vaccinated as us. Herman, your thoughts?
Well, I think firstly, this sort of vaccine nationalism and vaccine apartheid, so it reminds me always when a political party blames the media. I mean, it's just so obvious that you're trying just to play the blame game. But I think there are four things at play here. Incompetence, as Sarah said. But then I think there are three more devious things at play. Number one, corruption. Number two, malice. And number three, ideology. And Sarah touched on ideology, the fact that it must be central controlled. It must be, you know, command economy style distribution. But then I do think there's an element of malice here, because the longer the crisis, the longer they can use the Disaster Management Act. The longer South Africa is in a state of pandemic panic, government can ignore constitutional democracy, essentially, it seems. So I think there is an element there of, you know, don't waste a good crisis. It's like when you're walking to a class you don't want to go to, you walk really slowly. So I think there is there's an element of malice here. And then I suspect there's an element of corruption here, because the patronage network of the ANC is so fundamental to its unity and existence that if there is no opportunity for the ANC at whatever level to gain benefit from government deals and tenders, then that is a real threat to ANC unity. So I think it's a toxic combination of corruption, incompetence, malice, and ideology. And I think you'll find reasons to believe all four of those are present. And the one thing that really, really gets me down is this command idea. Because this centralized control, specifically of the vaccine, is ridiculous. It's utterly ridiculous for two reasons. Number one, it's slowing the whole process down. It's just obvious. If the state is going to be a bottleneck, it's going to slow the whole process down. Number two, if taxpayers' money are going to be used to pay for these things, then me, a middle-class, relatively wealthy South African, my vaccine, if I ever were to get one before my 43rd birthday, would be paid for by some of the poorest taxpayers in this country. Poor people will be subsidizing me getting a vaccine. And I just think that's disgusting. I must say, this is this whole thing. And it's not as if anyone could have been caught off guard by this. From the get-go, the vaccine was immediately seen as a breakthrough, do-or-die moment the world over. It was clear to everyone that this moment was coming. The fact that a country can be so poorly prepared for the distribution of vaccines. If we take into account the relatively successful distribution of ARVs a decade ago, I mean, you have to ascribe it to you know, these four things that I've mentioned. I can't see any other way for it to make logically sense.
Right. This is exactly why when people in South Africa talk about, oh, are you going to get the vaccine? Did you hear about the side effects? Because, of course, there's, you know, been some problems with the J&J vaccine that have been widely publicized. I always just sort of laugh because I think it's a moot point. You know, why do we have to worry about something that's so far away?
Yes, I think Jacob Zuma is closer to jail than any vaccine is to my arteries.
Indeed. <J's> arteries. Yeah, anyway, so obviously we're going to keep talking about this because it's, I think in my mind, this is one of the most incredible displays of incompetence and ineptness by the national government, probably since the ANC came to power. I mean, you know, local government, you can probably find places where the ANC has done a worse job. But on the national level, this is probably right near the top, at least in the top five, maybe number one. Any thoughts on that, Herman? Do you agree with my?
Yes, I do. It breaks my brain just to understand how really bad at this you must be. I mean, these people are people that make losses on monopolies. Skill, but to be so useless at this when you've had a year to
Perhaps I can put in perspective the shame of this. If you think of, in African terms, the continent of Africa, the relative quality of the private sector and the quality of the medical knowledge, wisdom, of the people giving advice to the government. I mean, really, you know, vaccinologists, biologists, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, a very high level of academic and practical expertise. Given those two, it's beyond disgrace.
And something that also just, you know, that just came to mind that's been bothering me is silence. Almost absolute acquiescence from the medical community or the medical sector, not a public peep that's worth any criticism of the government. I mean, if Lily Livard had a face, South Africa's corporate baby would be that thing. It will be like taking South Africa's medical sector and South Africa's corporate financial sector and putting their faces into one of those websites that generates, how would your baby look face? And you would get the face of perfect cowardice. You would look at the platonic manifestation of cowardice. Because, you know, while this goes on, nothing, not a word from any influential medical body to criticize the government. Just, you know, hush, hush, let's, you know, Cyril's a good man.
Right. So if you are a South African and you are looking to get vaccinated, perhaps you should consider a holiday to Eswatini, Senegal, Zimbabwe, Togo, or Ghana, because they all seem, you all seem to be more likely to get a vaccine there. Those anyway, that is all we have time for.
Civilization, bastions of technological and medical advancement.
Yes, with great wealth and enormous prosperity on our way. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. On that somewhat cynical note, we shall see you tomorrow, and we will be back with the story of Gabriel's adventures in Mpumalanga on Thursday. But we'll see you tomorrow as well. Thank you very much, and have a wonderful day.